brief introduction, a little bit of, about the overview. One of the things that we talked about at the Great Schools Partnership and the New England Consortium is to try to take away from the presentation the scalability. How does this work, or can it work in my school district? And of all the presentations that we've heard over the past year, that's always the thing that we try to push people with. What barriers did you overcome? How did you do this? How did you do that? Now, this is my school district. How do you think it would work there? So I'm sure that David and his group will talk about the scalability, talk about the data that they've gathered. But certainly, they're doing some great things in Nashua in terms of collecting the data, using the data to inform instruction, talk about professional development and things of that nature. So I'll introduce David Ryan, who's the principal, and he's going to introduce his team. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Skip. Thank you. Good morning. With me today, we have two assistant principals. This is Chris Motika, who is the assistant principal of our Transitional Academy. To some, it's known as the Freshman Academy. Keith Richard is the assistant principal of the Exploratory Academy, which is grade 10, our sophomore academy. And we've also brought Chris Saunders, who is the head teacher of English for our school, and he has about 15 or 16 teachers under his watch, if not more. 16 teachers, and largely responsible for a lot of the success that we've had, as these two gentlemen to my left have had. Benchmark assessments can sometimes frighten some folks. They think it's going to be very dry. One thing we try to not be at North is dry. We want it to be exciting. We want it to be a conversation. So we're going to, we have, I believe, 75 minutes there, somewhere in there, Skip, to have a conversation about how we've been able to transform a lot of our instructional practice at our school. We have approximately 2,000 students. I supervise 126 teachers. We have six different academies, freshman, sophomore academy, and then four career academies that have approximately 250 students per. We have an urban population as well as an affluent suburban population, so we have a nice healthy mix. A number of different languages are spoken at Nashua North. We have a very vibrant ELL program. We also have a vibrant special education program. It's a terrific place. It's where you get to see the world as you walk through the halls, and it's a fun place to come and work. I know we have one former employee who's with us, and we're glad to see her in the audience. And so she'll be able to relate to some of the things that we're talking about, and maybe even add into the conversation. So we'll begin first by going through a couple of items. One thing we want to be able to do is define some of our vocabulary contextually. So in the spirit of being a good literacy strategist, which is one of the strategy or benefits that we have of looking at data and implementing literacy and numeracy strategies, we want to be able to provide some context for the words that we're going to be using in our presentation. I think everybody could define these words, but in terms of how we're using them, BAR, BAM, and BASS are benchmark assessments in reading, math, and science. BAR and BAM are essentially they're assessments of our state standards of released items, and we learn how to create them, learn how to score them, learn how to develop them with the help of Measure Progress. Measure Progress was a vendor that we contracted with. A lot of you know them as just people who make tests, and that is clearly not the case because we were able to enter into a pretty sizable professional development contract with Measure Progress. And if you have the opportunity to move forward with this kind of work, and I hope you do, please contact them. We're going to also be presenting with Measure Progress at the end of June the New Hampshire Association of School Principals up at beautiful Mount Washington, a place where I could not afford unless they were paying for it. So it's nice to have them on board as a team. What the BAR, BAM, and BASS does is certainly it measures growth. And we administer it to 8th, 9th, and 10th graders. We're on our Form 5 now, which is the last of the five assessments for our current sophomores. What we're doing is really preparing them, to take the test, the NECAP, and for those of you who don't take the NECAP, but whatever your standard state assessment is in the fall. But we're also looking to gather data because we want to try and identify where are our gaps in instruction, where are students' strengths, where are teaching strengths, and where are we missing the mark in terms of teaching frameworks instead of the content that we prefer to teach. And that's a very important point that we'll perhaps come back and talk about in a little bit. In terms of formative assessment, I believe, Chris, you want to talk about formative assessment and what it means to National North?
Yeah, we'll get into it in much more detail in a little bit, but when we talk about formative assessment, the key thing to remember is that we're talking about ungraded assessments in order to gain data, gain access to what our students know, what they don't know, and figure out from there where we need to meet our students.
Good. Bubble kit?
Yeah, if you look at the back of your packet, you have a chart here. Last page, just flip it right over.
These are our bubble kits. Unfortunately, not unfortunately, but I did take their names away. But this is what we do with our data to find out who our bubble kids are. And going across, you can find the scores of the... We have five band bars, okay? Take one in end of their eighth grade, two in ninth, two in tenth, leading up to the kneecap in 11th grade. So we want to know how we're looking before we get to our 11th grade kneecap. So we provide all that data on the back here. So we can know how a kid's doing in math, reading. We also pull up their 8th grade kneecap. So if you see the kneecap scores, the 8 before the number, they are scoring like 800s on their SATs here. And just the 8 indicates that they're in 8th grade. And then, you know, they scored 20s and 30s there. These are our bubble kids. These are the kids that we targeted. They were not receiving any ELL or special ed services. So these are the kids who are probably sliding through D's, C's, nice kids. We gave them the D- for the smile and not giving us any trouble. But you know what? They were probably missing gaps. And these are the kids that we wanted to target. So when we talk about bubble kids, this is where we were able to pull them from. One last note on that is data doesn't give it alone. We had to provide this list with the students' names to our teachers because anecdotal data is huge. We had kids that showed up on our list that we know are in our honors classes and looking to get into AP. Well, guess what? They didn't take the test seriously. So when we called them down and asked them if they needed intervention, they were kind of taken back. And we saw an increase in scores the next time they took an assessment standardized test. So we did have to kind of work through that with the kids as well. As David and we're going to talk about the changing the mindset of the teachers, we also had to change the mindset of the students. And that was one way we did it.
It looks like many of your students on this list are proficient, because 840 is proficient.
Yep, some of these kids.
So you're targeting kids that are receiving a 3?
We're looking at, we were talking about 840. The way this is sorted, I'm not sure the way this is sorted. So they might have been sorted by the BAM scores.
Okay.
But the group that we selected, good question, is just below proficient and just over that proficient, because we thought kids could go back. And we also wanted to bring kids out, so we didn't want any retraction as well. So that's a good question.
And an 840, the proficiency
slides.
So it's 840 is right literally on the bubble of proficiency.
Right. Yeah.
And it can be 1 year, it can be proficient, and maybe the next a few years later it's not. So it is clearly a bubble score.
Yep, and that's why we're talking about those kids that are right on that line.
Good.
Chris?
We're going to go over the development of the benchmark assessment, and we're going to go over the entire process that we use to score the student papers. When we use the term benchmark, we use it at least two ways. The benchmark assessment is the actual example of a state assessment. So when we say benchmark assessment in reading, it's an example of a reading assessment. We also use the term benchmark to signify a paper that has been scored from a 1, in terms of reading, it would be constructed response scored 1 through 4. So a benchmark paper would be one that's clearly a 1, 2, or 3, or a 4. In qualifying, when we say qualifying, all of our teachers who score the papers need to go through the exact same process of eligibility as anyone who would score for measured progress. So we go through a qualifying process at the school, and so when the teacher qualifies and they are qualified to score, and I'll go over all of that in a minute. Steve?
Just a quick question about when you created your benchmark assessment pieces, whether it's the R, the M, or the S, you've still done that in the same format as the kneecap as well?
Yes, they model
multiple choice and open response.
Yes, one of our goals when we established when we created the test was to model it as closely as possible to the state test.
Still scored by measured progress?
No, we score them. We score them, but when we started scoring, we scored with measured progress. They were there, but our teachers, everything is done in-house. So the first, we're on form five. On the first three forms, they were with us. There was someone in the room with us when we scored. On the last couple, we score on our own.
You try to duplicate, excuse my voice, you try to duplicate testing environment.
Yeah, and we're gonna go over all of that. There is a protocol for our administration, and it's actually led to changes in the way that we actually administer the actual NECAP test.
Yeah, the beauty of the process was the measured progress essentially taught us how to fish. We can follow the parable. Literacy, when we speak of literacy, I know you have, again, know how to define it. A lot of people think it's knowing how to read. To us, it means critical thinking, listening, reading, writing, and speaking effectively across all content areas. So to be a literate student in numeracy would be relatively the same. Being able to identify and utilize not just mathematics in a math class, but understanding the numerical components across all content areas, whether it be reading a graph in a science class or a social studies class. Understanding what the written language means in a passage, whether it be a short story or a constructive response in an English class that combines numbers or utilizes measures. So when we use the term literacy and numeracy, that's what we're referring to, and that's been one of our key components of the improvement process. The last one is the CR for Chris.
CR, constructed response. And a lot of teachers, although they use them, they're not familiar with the terminology. It's quite simply, it's any short response to stimulus. So an open response doesn't usually have stimulus. There's a prompt. And the open response is generally quite a bit longer than a constructed response. And we highlight constructed response because of our data showed us that many students that don't do well on the NECAP test actually tank the constructed response portion of the reading. They just don't do it. And so it's a short response to stimulus. And in the case of the reading, it's a reading passage. In the case of math, it's a math problem where they're asked to explain something. So constructed responses can be administered in any class, in any discipline.
I took my watch off and put it down so I can see the time. We tend to get a little excited as we get going. We get passionate about the things that we've accomplished. So please, if we go past our time or we near that time, we want to be able to give people plenty of opportunity to ask questions. Just say, hey, you're long-winded, knock it off. We've got the power, we're good. Can we ask questions now? Just fire that at us. Obviously, everybody can read today's objectives. We want you to be able to walk out of here and start something Monday. I did originally have tomorrow in there, but I forgot it was Friday, so we wouldn't make you do this on a Saturday. But we want you to be able to do something on Monday. So we gave you a number of appendices toward the end of the packet that have a lot of information and give you examples of some of the things that we've used to stimulate some of the work that we've done. Okay. The most important thing, and Skip alluded to it, is obviously the culture within your district. And all of you who work in school districts know the culture that right now pervades. When you speak of data, typically in a classroom, to a teacher, in my experience, they've kind of put their hands up. And they said, well, slow down, I have to teach. I don't have time to pull data, I don't have time to look at data. And when I got to Nashua 4 years ago, it was very, very similar to that. It was a district that was under a lot of change, so to speak. I was hired by a superintendent who, unfortunately, a week after I was hired, left. And we had an interim superintendent. We were also in the midst of a teacher contract issue where the following year we were 6 hours away from the teacher strike. We had three assistant principals who were at the school who, about 2 weeks after I was hired in the summer, left. So we hired essentially a whole new administrative team. And a year later, we had a new administrative team. And a year later, we had a new administrative team. So this is the first year that we've actually had a team come back for the second time, which is great. So I'm the longest tenured administrator at North. I've only been there for 4 years. It's pretty funny. So you have to look at that and say, oh, how the hell did we get all that work done? It comes down to making sure you hire the right person. We've hired probably 70 out of 126 teachers over the last 4 years. I have 45 teachers right now under 3 years of experience. Period. Not in Nashua. Period. which is actually a really good thing. Because when we hire our teachers, we hire them based on a character sketch. And we look at the kind of person. If you get in front of us, it means we've selected you based on what's on your paper. You're qualified, which is very, very different than quality. So if you get to us, you're qualified. You have a degree. You're certified. You're HQT by virtue of your certification. And you may have some experience. You may not, but you came from the school of ed. Great. Now, talk to me about how you're going to help us transform education. And a lot of times people look at you and say, I really don't know what you mean. And we try to explain them, give them some scenarios. We try to hire a person who, first of all, loves kids. Has to love kids. And some of you, who has teachers that don't love kids? Yeah, we had some. And that's really hard to understand, isn't it? You know, a race car driver loves to drive. How many race car drivers don't love to drive? I don't know of one. Okay. You have to hire people who are ready to do just about anything to demonstrate that they are a good teacher. And when you have a first or second or third year teacher coming to you, they're not a good teacher yet. They're not. They're a great person. Because we haven't taught them to be a good teacher. So when we hire someone, we hire somebody based on what we feel they're going to be professionally 5 years from now. So the person we hired this spring for a special education job, we feel will be an excellent teacher 5 years from now. But that person's going to grow with us. And the way they're going to grow is by giving them a lot of leadership opportunities. We're not going to ask them to go into the classroom, close the door, bathroom's down to the left, here are your keys. Good luck. We welcome them in. We have, obviously, an induction program. We have strong head teachers who are leaders on their own. And then we get folks involved in getting in front of our staff and leading things such as scoring on an early release afternoon where we had one second-year teacher lead that. And then we have other teachers leading our literacy committee. We have other teachers presenting to staff. We just pull them into leadership. So you have to have people who are ready to be hired to buy into change. I'm ready to help you change. And when we say change, we can use the word transform. We can use the word improve. Because change and improve to me mean the same thing. Because if what we're doing right now isn't working for all kids, then hell yeah, we're going to improve what we're doing. And that's a change. Because we're going to change the things that we're doing. You have to have people that are willing to do that. Now, those of you that have a veteran staff, we also had a pretty solid veteran staff. And we'll give you some anecdotes about that as we move forward. Some veterans who, you know, they just weren't ready to take on some of this data work. It's a four-letter word to them. And I would point out, yeah, that has four letters. You're right. That shared leadership is really important. These two gentlemen, they run their schools. They have 500 pupil schools. That is their job. I hold them accountable. And in order for them to do their job, they have to have teachers that they can rely on that they then hold accountable. And those teachers, who are typically head teachers or teacher leaders down in their departments, hold other teachers accountable. Because with 2,000 kids, there's no way I'm going to be able to do any kind of work in our school other than answer the phone, answer email, write evaluations, unless I have people who are willing to all pitch in and do the work. And the way we get to that, this is one of those pieces with the veteran staff, is you have to ask people to give you an ethical answer in regard to improving instruction. And you have to put questions up in front of your staff, and you have to stand there and say, are you in the right classroom? And are the right kids in front of you? And they'll say, well, I don't really know what you mean. I said, okay, does everyone in this room believe, and I'm asking you now, that our neediest students need our best teachers? Is that a pretty, we can all pretty much agree to that? So if I ask that to my faculty, and then I say, okay, you sir, you teach three levels or three courses of AP psychology. You're a great teacher. But I have a lot of kids. We have a 34% poverty rate. I have a lot of kids who really could use you. Oh, well, wait a minute. I wasn't talking about me. I teach AP psychology. You have to break that. And you have to work on that ethical base that if we all agree that it's the right thing to do, then we can't stand around and just say it. Because what we're going to do as administrators is we're going to work with you through the observation and evaluation process to do one of two things. We're going to transform you into believing in it. Doing it, we're going to transform you into a former National High School North employee. And that's how serious we get when we talk to our teachers about doing the right thing, because we believe it. That's how you get improvement. You have to get buy-in. We've talked about primary and secondary level leaders. The vision that we have, you have to have a vision for success. You have to know what you want your kids to look like by the time they're done at your school. You can't just open the doors and go to your offices or classrooms and just teach and hope that kids get it. And I think you all know that because that's why you're here. But as a leader, whether you're a district leader or a state, in the State Department of Education, or you're working in a school, you have to understand that I want my kids to look like X. And at North, that's what we want. We want kids to be challenged. We want them to be exposed to equitable situations. That's that really good teacher, needy kid, matching them up. Normally don't get that. We want them to respond to social issues. So we have kids doing all kinds of different things. They go out in our community. We work with our business community partnerships. We had a student go over to overseas to do an extended learning opportunity where he worked on a sustainable farm and as a migrant worker for free, and then came back and presented to us. And then we want kids to be respectful. Chris will talk a little bit about how we get kids to do that and one of the rubrics that we use to measure kids' civic and social behaviors. We're one of the few high schools that actually reports conduct on our report cards and progress reports to parents for high school kids. So you get a 17-year-old kid who's not behaving, he gets a 2 instead of a 3, which is a type citizen. So you have to know what you want your kids to look like.
All right. I just wanted to, I get to do, I think, the best part. Proof is in the pudding. Here are our scores from last year's testing. And to be honest, when these scores were coming out, they came out in January. You could log on 7 a.m. I mean, we were like kids at the top of the stairs on Christmas morning asking the parents, I said, can we go down? Can we go down? Because we knew there were presents down there, but we didn't know how good the presents were going to be. And we were really excited. So at 7 a.m., we log on. And so you can see we had some minimal improvement from 2007, 2008. We went up 4 points. But then, man, we go up 11 points. Okay, so we're proud to say that 75% of that class are proficient readers. Okay? Pretty good. We're really excited about that. This next one really matters. We went up 22 points in writing. And what happened was, that Chris alluded to earlier, our kids were leaving those boxes blank. They didn't even want to touch them. Okay? But we worked through with the teachers first by doing a school-wide PD first thing in September, where the teachers gave all the kids the same constructive response. Together we scored it, and together they saw what a 4-3-2-1-0 would be. So they brought that back to the classroom and used that rubric. And proof is in the numbers right there. Now, is that 54? Do we want that higher? Yes. But from 32, that's just unbelievable. Okay? We are so proud of the fact. Then we kind of came back to reality a little bit. Math. We improved 1%. Okay? And I think that this is indicative of the initiatives we were doing. We were doing so much in literacy. We were doing so much that we thought that maybe by osmosis the math would just kind of come up. And it did. And now we know. Again, using the data, we know we need to embed strategies in math. And that conversation has already started. Okay, it's starting right now for science because our science scores across the state are abysmal. And we know that we're getting tested in May. And that's what happened. That's why the creation of the BAS happened. The creation of the BAS happened through our work with Measuring Progress. We did it on our own. We said, we need to get a benchmark. We don't know where our kids are. Where are the gaps? So that's why we created the BAS. And we did it. It was all teacher-driven. So we know that this will be our next, going into next year, here's what we're doing. This is a great slide again. We met AYP in reading in every disaggregate except for one. It's fed. Okay. And again, when this comes out, the people are excited of, well, what do we need to do? We're trying to identify, do we need to be providing more ALT assessments to these students? That do we really have kids testing that probably shouldn't be testing? Are we using the accommodations that NECAF allows us to do to the fullest extent? And the answer is no. And these are the kids that we really need to target. Because, and then on the other side, it's a complete opposite. We have all Y's in one end, all N's in one Y. Our Asian Pacific Islanders, they met AYP and the other groups didn't. So we know where we're headed. And this is great, and this is going to be not only summer work, but we're starting it now, and we're really jumping in. The next slide is, this is our disaggregates, just a breakdown. This is for both high schools. I was unable to get one slide of just North. But here is a breakdown of our disaggregates. You can see where we had some gains, where we flattened, dropped a little bit. But if you look at our limited English proficient.
Yeah, can I just ask you a question about math, quick?
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about what you think you're going to need to do and how it's different from the reading and the writing?
Yes, the first thing was, I think social studies teachers, science teachers, they found it easy to get the constructive responses of responses into their classroom.
Yeah.
A lot of our teachers are struggling to get math across the curriculum, and that's where we need to get involved. We need our kids practicing math more often than not.
Right.
And that's where I think we had the huge jump is every teacher was required to do constructive responses, even our math teachers. But math focused on math ones, and social studies, science for reading a text, comprehension, writing.
I guess what we're finding is that the pre-K-12 continuum doesn't set kids up to have the content to be prepared, because we have, you know, I mean, 65% of our students by the time October of their junior year comes around, they've just finished geometry.
Right.
They've had algebra,
And algebra 1 is our greatest failure in class. You know, we just have algebra 1, that's our greatest failure.
What I've been kind of saying to people is, what if we move the test to senior year of that of October, you'll see the scores go like this, because they'll have a year of algebra 2. But if you don't do that, then you've got to move the whole curriculum. You've got to move pre-K.
Yeah, well, we've made changes, and one of the things that the data isn't showing us yet are the pilot groups. This data is based on students who haven't even taken the benchmark assessments. And our math scores are actually just below the state average.
Yeah.
Our reading and writing were way below the state average. So it was, you know, we were really poor in those areas, and we made a lot of ground, and we're just above state average. So it looks a lot different. And if you think about the data that way, we're a point below the state average, or two in math. Our students come to us, 60% of our freshman students come below proficient. So we are experiencing the same thing that you are, and what we're saying is that's the way we get them. There are problems, you know, we can point all the way to the home, but we're not doing that. We're saying, okay, this is how we get them. What are we going to do? We anticipate a jump in our scores next year in math, because it's our first group of students that we've really concentrated our efforts on. We got a lot out of our juniors this year, and they haven't even none of them have taken a benchmark assessment.
So through the released items and your BAM, you're going to be assessing students on some of the trig and some of the Algebra 2 concepts.
Absolutely.
Even though they're not in those courses.
We do.
Yes.
We do. And we also created a year-long Algebra 1 class. I mean, we've made a lot of changes that we can talk
about.
That's
a good point. The kids that tested aren't the ones that have gotten all the interventions that we've been providing.
Yeah.
They haven't even taken the BAM.
Yeah.
They are a byproduct of just the strategies that have changed because
I think we'll be above average in math next year, above the state average. I really do, because of all the work that we've put into math.
And back to the data piece, one of the things that we've done is we've created not only just a literacy team, which Chris is chairing, but also a numeracy team that's coming out of the data from the benchmark assessments in math and the NECAP scores. And again, looking at those specific strands of grade span expectations, and then finding out where the gaps are so that we can tackle those individual problems with the students who are our bubble kids and also those well below the bar.
Thanks.
Is there a chance, a chance that we can get some of the curriculum that you've established for these groups?
Absolutely. Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah,
we'll
share it. The one thing I've kind of jumped ahead a little bit is, okay, curriculum. Great. We have a program in the bubble kids, and the numbers are a little bit off because that list is alphabetical, I didn't sort it, so I apologize for that because it would have been a lot better. But those bubble kids, one program we're doing at the sophomore level is we work with a small learning communities grant that we've been in, dropout prevention grants, and we've been able to have two retired special ed teachers to come back, and we call them academic interventionists, where from that list, they've pulled kids out and they meet with them, and they've used that data to try and fill those gaps. Like if those kids aren't, if they're in algebra one again, and we know they're going to be getting tested on trig and things like that, geometry, they're going to work with that, try giving them some examples of that. So that's one way we're trying to fill those gaps where they might not get to the class yet just because of they're not passing, or you know, maybe it's just not for them, but we are trying to get them influenced a little bit, or a little, you know, taste of it. So
yeah, and with that, we had to get buy-in from our teachers to let kids out of class in order to come down and do that, because we're working a 90-minute block. And if you miss 35 minutes of a 90-minute block, you essentially miss the class. And
instead of the principal, the assistant principals, going to classroom teachers and saying, listen, we want you to let your kids out of class, we let our two retired smooth-talking interventionists contact these people who they know and say, here's what I want to do for your student. And when they come back, they're going to be a better math teacher for you. And it might be your science class or your English class or even phys ed class or something like that. The student's still responsible for the work when they return. But the teachers have to buy in order to be able to provide that makeup work for that student to do in support of the program. What I wanted to do just with this slide was these numbers, what this means is that North, last year we had a 40% increase in the number of kids who enrolled in AP. We doubled our enrollment in AP. We had 40% increase in the number of kids who took the test. And statewide it was 4.9%, and internationally it was 7.5%. The best part about it was that the number of exams scored from 3 to 5, we went up 38%. Where in the state it was 6.9%, and we seen we had the College Board actually come visit us on Tuesday because they kind of wanted to look and see how our kids did so well so quickly, because when you get a larger N, typically your scores would go down, and in this case ours went up dramatically, and they wanted to know what happened. And so what we did was we talked about the strategies that we were implementing, literacy, numeracy, but really a lot of the writing strategies across the curriculum. You could walk into a woodworking class and they're doing a constructive response where they're responding to something that they read about, I don't know, cutting wood or making a birdhouse or something along those lines. And something that simple and all of the mechanics that go into that was used as a strategy for our one of our wood teachers to teach wood. And so we went from teachers looking at us saying, I have to take time out from teaching my content to teach these kids test strategies, to teachers saying, here's what we're going to do today to learn about hickory wood. We're going to read this article. I've got a couple of questions for you. I want you to fill that box, guys. Let's go. 10 minutes. Let's move. And it was impressive because our kids were able to jump in their school. And they didn't cheat. That I promised the lady from the College Board, they did not cheat.
The best thing about these scores, too, is it validates the staff what we're doing. It's, you know, one of those things we're asking you to do with this, well, where are the results? Well, the results are right there, you know what I mean? And now the math department's feeling a little heavy. It's like, oh, geez, we want those same results. What do we need to do? So they're digging in. They're excited. They're ready to go. But there has been, again, that change in philosophy of what do you do with standardized tests? And what do we do with NCLB? And, they're, you know, these state assessments, they're not going away. The way they use them and the way, you know, schools will be identified, things like that might change. But we want you to maybe just take a minute at your tables right now, and how does your school district use these state assessments? What is the purpose of it, and what does your school district see as the purpose of these? So just take 2 minutes, maybe you guys can just share, when those scores come out, what are the conversations happening at each school district that you guys are at? So we don't run out of time, okay? We kind of came up with some predetermined answers, but I'm just going to kind of go through. How many people thought that the purpose of this was just for designation purposes? It pretty much tells you you're a school and need improvement. Great. What does that do? You know, just fills your morale. Awesome. I work at a school that needs improvement. What does that tell me about myself? Two, when those scores come out, how many people definitely compare their school to another school within their district? Always, right? What are they doing over there? Or
you know, you feel, you walk into school maybe a little bit prouder because, you know, the other elementary school maybe, or, you know, middle school didn't do as well as you did. And but that can be tough because, again, different staffs, different populations, things like that. Harvard people may have talked about it as an educational tool, okay? Great, and that's where we're trying to get to. We've got to get over that philosophy of it's, let's get them in, test them, get them out, we'll get the scores, we move on, okay? That's been our biggest change, right, is the buy-in. How can we use this? And what does that data provide us? We bought in. It's an educational tool, and it's provided us the roadmap as we move forward through this. The end result is those kneecap scores. But what do we have to do prior to get those results to improve? And that's where we will bring you down that road right now. Yes, go ahead.
How do you overcome the philosophical mindset that educators have? In other words, you're born when you teach to a test.
We're gonna, that's actually a slide up here, and I don't know if
we
want to say
it
earlier.
We can
jump
on it.
Good question.
We were hoping someone would ask
that. How many people, just by a quick show of hands, have always heard that, oh, we're teaching to the test, this is bad, this is not good? We've kind of started to embrace it because of the fact is that our state standards, think about it, what are our state tests, what are they based on? They're based on the state standards. What should we be teaching in the classroom? The state standards. So in turn, by teaching to the test, we're teaching standards. And if we're not, we have to ask the question, what are teachers doing in the classroom? Are they teaching a book because they love to teach it? Are they teaching it because they've always taught it? And then the question is, what are kids really learning? Are they learning the skills and concepts they need, or are they simply learning about a great piece of literature that might be classic but doesn't relate to our skills?
We turn that question right on its head, and we say, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing to improve student achievement? What do you do as an individual in your classroom to improve student achievement? And how do you align what you're doing in your class to the state standards? So we've shifted from an English department that thinks we need to cover titles to an English department that thinks we need to teach skills. All right, we're not about getting through 10 books. We'll settle on a few if we can teach skills. And so that's what we're asking. We want people into the GSEs. We want people in our school who are familiar with the GSEs. And what I would say to people who ask that question is, would you ever give a test in your classroom that you did not prepare your students for? So why aren't we preparing students for the highest stakes test that they take? Now, we've already shown you the transfer to AP, and we also have a transfer to SAT scores, okay? I never have any problem in an English class the week before an SAT saying, hey, how many of you guys would like to try one of the SAT writing prompts? I happen to have a couple right here. Those juniors who are taking the SAT, none of them say, nah, you know, they all want to go at it, okay? And so we face that, but what we think that betrays more about the person who asked the question. That really does. That's an opportunity for us to really bring an educator along when they start asking questions like that. The other thing I'll say is that the people at Measured Progress, they are geniuses, the people who make these tests up. If you interact with them at all, if you go to test, send your teachers to test driving development, send them to, get them involved in this stuff, and they'll realize these tests are not being made by nitwits, okay? Which a lot of the teachers say, oh, it's just BS. It's not. It's nuts and bolts. The reading and the writing test nuts and bolts English language arts. And if a teacher doesn't get that, you know, they're just stalling, and they're not on board, clearly not on board. We try to bring them on board. I'm just going to go over with you as quickly as I possibly can the actual bar. And did I say a hand up? No. The test item development, test administration, and then benchmarking and qualifying, okay? This is what we do. This is the actual instrument that we use. When we started 3 years ago, we decided that what we wanted to do is we wanted to create tests in math and reading that were modeled after the kneecap test. And so we got in touch with the kneecap people, Measured Progress, they came in, and you can start, you don't need to, I mean, this can all be done in-house. It doesn't need to be done with a huge contract with an outside agency. Your teachers are not familiar with these. They ought to be. These are the released items. All of our tests, all of our benchmark assessment tests, are based on released items. And you can get on the internet and you can pull down released items from every single state in this nation and from Europe and Canada. There are released items out there. And what we do with each test, we've given the test now, it'll be our fifth administration coming up in June for the benchmark assessment in math and reading. And for each one, we sit and we go over test items and we align the test items to the GSEs. So we know exactly what we're asking. And we have formed each test after we've analyzed the data from the previous test. Okay? So David mentioned to you distributed leadership. We have teachers designing these tests and reviewing each test item. We go over and we have a conversation about it with teachers, and we talk about the test item, and we talk about how it's aligned to the GSEs, and we talk about what we're trying to get from the student, and we talk about the distractors, and we rewrite questions. And so we have developed every single test that we have given in-house, and they're all based on released items. So that all of that is available to you. You can bring that, you can Google that today. New Hampshire Department of Education, released items. In every state test that we have, there are released items. So our test, I mentioned before, this is a copy of our test. It looks exactly like a NECAP test. It looks exactly like it. So next year, when our juniors take the NECAP test, they will have taken it 5 times. In the last 2 years. It will be their 6th time on the NECAP test in 2 years. Okay?
We always use a sports analogy. Why would you not practice before a game? And then if you're in a practice, why wouldn't you do game situations? Our kids are going to walk into that NECAP in October, and they've done it so many times before that it's not a big deal.
Is it administered school-wide?
Yeah, I'm going to go to test administration in 1 second. Yes? A GSE is a grade span expectation. In New Hampshire, we don't go on grade level in high school. So we have grade level GLEs from kindergarten through 8th grade, and then when they get into high school, we go to GSEs, and those are grade span expectations. And there's the students in New England on the NECAP are tested on the 9-10, the 9-10 GSEs. Test administration. We actually have learned a lot about how to give a test during this process. And we mentioned that there was a spike in our scores with our juniors, and we hadn't done anything. Well, we did. We have learned how to take a test, and we can go over how we did it with our NECAP students this year in a second. With the BAM in the bar, we dedicate a morning where we'll have the entire freshman and sophomore classes taking the BAM in the bar at a certain time. The whole school buys in. All teachers administer a test of some sort at that time with the juniors and the seniors while the freshmen and sophomores are taking the BAM in the bar. Perhaps the seniors are taking an SAT prep test, and the juniors may be taking another NECAP test prep based on released items. So it's a school-wide effort. We actually, on some days, when we administer the NECAP, we have a delayed opening. We have the juniors come in, and no one else comes in, unless we're going to administer a BAM and bar, and then we'll have the freshmen and the sophomores come in, and the juniors come in, and the seniors will come in a little bit later. That frees up our staff, and we have as few students as possible with each staff member in terms of administration. For the NECAP, we ask teachers, who do you want to give the test to? We create a list. We ask students, who do you want to take the test to? Students will work harder on a standardized test with teachers they like than they will if you jam them into a cafeteria which we would never do.
Boy, we learned that, didn't we?
Yeah, we administer our AP test this year for the first time. We're out of our building. We're going to a local parish hall where they're going to be able to spread out, and they're working with us. And so, in terms of test administration, we think it's an integral aspect of how we do our business. But it's all done in-house. Benchmarking and qualifying, once we give the students the test, we need to score it. That's not done through measured progress. They have come in and they have watched us work and they have helped us and they have answered questions, and they actually taught us the benchmarking qualifying process. But we're basically doing it on our own. As a matter of fact, we administered a benchmark assessment in science a few weeks ago, and on Tuesday, five science teachers will be going through the benchmarking and qualifying process. On Wednesday, they'll bring that process to the entire science department. And then on Thursday, the science department is going to train the whole school. So every single teacher in our school will be trained in assessing science papers as of Thursday. And we've gone through the same process with our reading and our math. All of our teachers have gone through a qualifying experience. What constitutes qualifying is taking a good hard look at exemplars, all right, and then actually taking a test, scoring 10 papers. So here's a qualifying set. Okay, it says it's based on a passage called The Locket. Okay, and what we have are live papers. I have live papers here. And so a teacher will meet with us for, I'd say, an hour, and then sit and actually score 10 papers. And what they have to score 8 of them right, and then they're qualified. And then, once we get a batch of qualified teachers, we score the entire set of live papers. And our numbers are increasing as we have been more successful. We have more people qualifying. We have more people teachers walk away from the qualifying experience and say, wow. And I've had teachers who will criticize us for every single thing that we do to improve student achievement, have come up to us afterwards and said, that was the best PD I've ever been through. And you just think, okay, we just sold something to someone who has never bought from us in years. And those are the types of experiences that we're having. Yes.
Do you have teachers do cross-content qualifying? So
yeah.
HQT math teacher will learn.
Yeah, and we have English teachers on our numeracy committee, and we have math teachers on our literacy committee. We have math teachers who score English papers, English teachers who score math papers. We're all trained in the school to score papers, and it helps because you as administrators, real well that an A in Mr. Smith's class might not be an A in Mr. Jones' class. And so when you get people scoring papers and you start talking about student work, and it's real student work, this is they're our students. We have teachers whose jaws drop when they see little Joey's paper and he's tanked the constructed response, and then we can talk to little Joey about that. We've had students who are in the National Honor Society score very, very low on our benchmark assessments, and we've had to have people ask them, what happened? And then the next time around they tend to score as well as they possibly can. So the qualifying is a very, very valuable professional development experience. And like I said, there are I have never, and this is one thing I promised my teachers, leading them through the qualifying, it's not just me, there are four of us and other English teachers, so it's not just the head of the department. It is, we push out in terms of leadership as much as we possibly can. And so when we do professional development for the literacy committee, I am not standing in front of the staff and saying, do this because I'm the head of the English department. Not like that at all. We have first and second year teachers presenting to them. And they, the staff tends to buy in when they see the kids right out of college. And another nice thing about the people right out of college is that they come with this stuff. You know, when we were teaching, we went through the NEASC accreditation this year, and we had to teach some of our old codgers what a rubric is. But our younger teachers all came with that, and so it is nice working with the people who are getting that in college. The qualifying, again, live papers, real people. The last thing I want to say on is nobody fails qualifying. This says qualifying set one. If you fail this, I sit with you in qualifying set two. Okay? So there are two qualifying sets. I'm not saying I give people the answers, but in scoring papers, one of the basic ideas of scoring papers is you should be able to talk about it. People should be able to ask questions. We should be talking about student work. If you're not sure, you know, and that's what's nice, once we're all qualified, we sit in a room and score the papers together. Of course, we get some good laughs, and we also get to talk about the papers that are challenging in terms of the score. Quickly then, we get the data. We get it immediately. We get it within a few weeks. What do we do with it? Well, we look at it. All data for us does present opportunities. All right. It doesn't scare us. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't make us wish that we weren't looking at it. It provides us with opportunities, particularly with opportunities for students. It gives us opportunities for professional development. In terms of students, what we've done, if you look at that the last page, the data on the last page, there's a student name attached with all the data. We actually give it to the teachers. We give data to teachers, and we ask for anecdotal evidence. On the pullout, when we're doing the pullout, one of the ways we get teacher buy-in is we ask teachers, of your students, which ones do you think could benefit from this? All right? And so if you're telling me you think that your student, that there are some of your kids that will benefit from this and you want them to have the tutorials, you can't really tell us, well, they can't come out of my class, or Mr. Jones' students can't come out of my class. So we have created, and I have to applaud the administration at our school has created a culture where almost everybody has bought in. And you know, we try to work around people that haven't, but they're kind of backing themselves into a corner, and there are very, very, very few people who have not bought in. Yes. So
I know we're talking a lot about the teachers buying in. I'm wondering about the students, and is there an incentive that's offered to the students to, aside from simply doing well on the test and seeing that change take place for them?
I think what's interesting about the students is that the students really they want to do well. Students want to do well. The students that we interview students for our intervention program, we don't make students get pulled out of class. We interview them, and we only give intervention to those who want it. Guess what? They all want it. At North, I only know of one student. I know there probably are more, but I work very closely with both interventionists, and I only know of one story where a student said, no, I don't want intervention. I don't want to have any part of this. And usually what they say to us is thank you. The more capable students, what we tell them is, look, we use analogies. I mean, I had a little uprising in a class. I had a teacher call me in, a social studies teacher, said, Mr. Saunders, I was walking by. Can you come in here and quell this uprising? And one of the boys happened to have a football jersey on, and he said to me, we know how to do constructive response. We don't need any more of these. And they were undefeated, the football team at the time. And I said, oh, it's kind of like your football season, isn't it? And he said, what? And I said, have you guys lost yet? And he said, no. And it was about 4 weeks into the season. It was a nice little run they were on. And I said, so what's your coach saying? He kind of looked at me. And I said, no, really, what's your coach saying? No practice today? We're undefeated? And so, you know, you could see the heads in the room. And then there were a few other kids that might have been turned off by the athletic analogy. So I looked at another kid who had hair about down to the middle of his back. And I knew he was in our school band. He's a guitar player. So I said, how about you? Are you all set in terms of your music? Do you need to practice anymore, or are you where you want to be on guitar? And he said, no, I need to practice more. I said, okay, same thing. All good writers I said, you sell it to kids like that. You know, my top kids in AP, when they question me about making a correction on their work, I say, hey, look, Fitzgerald was rewriting The Great Gatsby when he died, 20 years after it was published. If it's good enough for them, you know, we can do the same. It's an evolutionary process. None of us people who have an education have ever stopped learning how to write. So, you know, you have to make arguments with kids, but you appeal to their intelligence, and they appreciate it.
Another quick piece of information. I know we're getting short on time, but for the most recent administration of the Bam and Bar for the ninth grade class, there were 17 out of 500 students absent that day, which is remarkable. Kids came in, their parents called in, and they said, is my kid going to be able to make up this test? They really want to take it. I had a girl who hit her, the back of her head on a diving board in a diving competition. And in the pool, she said to her coach, I really need to be in school tomorrow because I want to take my benchmark assessments. So just a couple pieces of information about the culture amongst the students.
So if there is a massive culture shift in our school, and we knew we were going to get the question, so we just threw it up there. We knew it would happen. It happens all the time. Go ahead.
This is the other piece to it. All right.
If you look at there's a constructed response on the catcher in the rye in your packet. All right. Your teachers are doing that. They're doing that type of thing. And the difference may well be, the only difference may be that our teachers more often than not can tell us what GSC it's aligned to. Right? All of those questions on that catch, there are four questions. Each one of them is related to, I think two of them are vocabulary GSEs, and one of them are, and two of them are literary, analyzing literature.
So basically the big thing with knowledge of standards is right now our teachers are not only are they aware of the grade span expectations and where their curriculum meets the expectations, but they're informing students about what students need to know. The beginning of every class, we want teachers posting objectives, posting classroom goals for the day, all right? And that's translating into students being able to say, yeah, I know how to, you know, draw inference out of this piece of literature. Or I know how to multiply or find slope in an equation, whatever it might be. So teachers are talking about standards, and students are talking about standards. With formative assessment, we're making sure that our teachers are giving informal checks for understanding as often as possible. One of the key things is ungraded checks for understanding. Whether it's a quiz that you don't grade, homework or classwork, or you know, whether it's simply saying, how many of you by a show of hands understand what I'm saying? You know, and okay, you, tell me a little bit about X, Y, or Z. So very informal checks for understanding, and then from there, working with the students who don't know. We've instituted a pause period, a school-wide pause period that Mr. Ryan will talk about.
It's called Tighten Up, because we're the Titans, T-I-T-A-N-S. Kids came up with that, actually. What it is we do a number of, we check with our kids through a period of 3-4 weeks each quarter. And our teachers are doing a number of different activities. And what they're trying to do is identify three different levels. And I've included the information in your packets. In the back's called the Tighten Up Summary. It's frequently asked questions. Has the agenda for the PD session we gave all of our staff during what's called the just-in-time, where teachers are able to come down during their plan to receive 30 to 45 minutes of instruction from members of the administrative team on upcoming programs. This happened to be one of them, so I gave you that agenda. I also gave you a copy of the summary sheet. And what happens is, on a given day, the first time we did it, the whole school stopped. We stopped teaching. And students, unwittingly, were in a reinforcement category, an intervention category, or an enrichment category. And the teacher had enrichment activities for those students who really excelled at the content. And a lot of teachers actually traded enrichment students. So enrichment students from physics went down to math, and they worked with the students in the intervention category. Students don't know what category they're in. They just know that they're working on this work. Our reinforcement students are those that just need some more practice in that content area. So where does that come in with all the benchmark assessments? Well, what we were able to do, if you go back to the knowledge of the standards, was when we would drill down and go through a performance track where all of our data gets loaded, and we do item analysis, where we sit around a table, teachers, administrators, counselors, we look at, geez, you know, it seems as though everybody failed to answer question 15 correctly. and look what standard it's aligned to. And look, 17, same thing. 17, 18, 19, they're all geared towards inferencing. Our kids can't read and gain something from a passage. Well, what are we going to do? Interesting. A lot of the assessment that went on in the classes leading up to that Tighten Up had to do with inferencing. Now we're looking at poetry because our kids are really struggling with poetry. You know why? Teachers aren't teaching it like they're supposed to. And a good portion of our state assessment is poetry. So when we just did our most recent CIA meeting, which is curriculum instruction assessment, we got together, we did our item analysis of the last bar, and we identified, geez, you know, poetry is really killing us. What else was killing us? Vocabulary development, which spurred school-wide vocabulary development program across all content areas with high-frequency words, which these two guys, again, you guys got big plates, they're working on with Chris and other head teachers and teachers. So you get to these Tighten Ups, and teachers now do them independently. And all I ask is that 3 or 4 weeks after you conduct a pause, complete that summary sheet, send it in, and it asks 3 very simple questions. I'm most interested in what did the students do and what's the gain. And then we've talked about rubrics. We've talked about how we've instituted rubrics, which we have a copy of some of our rubrics, our writing rubric, instructor response, and our civic and social rubric in the back of your packet. And then literacy and numeracy, which is a... we've talked, I think, quite extensively, actually. So, you know, you could guess that our results, which is why we're here telling you our story, which really is just our story. I mean, I'm hoping you're taking things from it and are able to think about your school. Okay, that would fit. Geez, you know, that wouldn't work. Because we're only one school. But we certainly have higher student achievement. We certainly have raised the level of expectations for our teachers, because when you have that bar and your teachers underneath that bar and you work with them, and they either go above the bar or they move out. Once that underneath that bar is empty, the bar goes up again. And there are more people under that bar. And those are the folks you work with the most. Certainly the learning community, ability to use data in our classrooms, in our hallways, in our cafeterias, all over the school, in our district. So this is what I wanted to get to ultimately is, what the heck are you going to be able to do come Monday? All right, maybe you're going to a Sox game this weekend. Lucky for you, if you go to Kansas City, you'll get to get in there. You can't get in Boston still. Find some people in your school or find some resources outside of your school to measure progress, excuse me, or we're happy to come if you want to contact us. There are a number of resources that can come support you and give you another leg up, because this was a very short presentation with a lot of stuff. Identify your existing data. What are your sources of data? It's everywhere in your school. Everywhere. The easiest one is using MeCap. It's free. We don't pay for it. It's free data. Kids give it to you. Try a whole school pause. Try it. See what works. See what doesn't. See how you want to change it. Begin researching your released items. Get right on the internet. You could do that in your phone. If someone else is driving you home back to Vermont or Maine, you can look right up and you can ask each other those questions. Be surprised. And then ask each other in Spanish. And now you know how the ELL students feel when they sit there in front of a test. Plan your staff PD sessions for scoring. Very simple, I think. Chris laid it out pretty easily for you, and we can certainly provide other information for you. And then your timeline. You always want to have a timeline. That vision, remember we talked about that vision? What do you want your kids to look like when they're done school? You got to do the same thing with this kind of programming. This is a major change. It was for us, and we hope that you're able to take some of what we've been able to offer you and apply it to some of your school improvement, because I know everyone's trying to improve what they're doing in their school and have some success like we did. So we are happy to answer any questions with the 5 minutes by my watch.
5 minutes.
I'll go, did Gail say 10? Because we'll go with 10.
I got a question.
Pam, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
Since you started this process, I guess you can decide when that happened. Is there something you can share that you wish you had known, that you know now?
The thing that I wish I had learned 10 years ago when I got into school administration was that data is a door. And what we've been doing, what I've been doing, is on that door is a sign that says, pull. And I've been pushing for 10 years. And data is that sign that tells me to full. And I finally recognized it just a few years ago. And how unbelievably helpful it is to actually know what you're talking about. Honestly, right? When you're talking to teachers about change, when you're talking to teachers about improving, what's your base? What are you going from? How do I know what you're doing? How do I know where I want you to go? Unless I have data. And I worked for a gentleman on my previous job who, again, a four-letter word, he wouldn't want to hear anything about it. We don't do that here. I don't see how you can have a school and not do it. So that would be the positive, is the realization. As far as the downside, go ahead.
I think something else that we really wish we had known was the testing environment in order to get the best data. That really took us a few times of going through the testing process to realize we want a smaller setting. We want to know who kids want to work with. We want to know who teachers want to work with. And that really, I think we've seen a huge jump in scores and just motivation during the testing process since we've done that.
The other would be you need to remember that there's a third party that you've created agency with, and that's your parents. And the first couple of times that we did the bar and the bam, parents weren't really on board. What do you mean my kid's taking another test? That's all you people do down there is test. And until we started to explain what we were doing by using our phones, because we have an Alert Now system, which some of you may have, it's an all-call system to homes, through your website, through your news, marketing the program is equally as important to the parents as it is to your kids. Your parents have to have buy-in. Because the night before we do the bar or the bam, I would always make that call home and say, I just want to remind everybody that tomorrow we have our benchmark assessments in reading math. We want to make sure your child gets a good night's sleep, make sure they eat breakfast when they come in and so forth. And for those of you who are in the upper grades, you're not going to be coming until later. So we had that group of parents. What do you mean my child's not coming until 9:15? I pay taxes. I pay your salary. Yeah, so you have to work through that. Sure.
I'm wondering if this sort of common assessment also went over to common assessments for all the algebra classes, or common assessments.
We have some, and we want more.
The math department specifically, they've really had a push, especially seeing their scores and wanting improvement. They've aligned with competencies. They've created competencies, and then they've created common assessments based on those competencies. They list competencies on the top of every single assessment that they give. And again, they're gathering that data and using time in professional learning communities. Again, through our Smaller Learning Communities grant, they're allowed paid time for that. They're working through some of those issues with the data.
So these two things are sort of important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we do, if it's way out here, we're not doing it.
How much time have you allotted for professional learning communities, and how have you implemented it in your school?
One of the great advantages that we presently have is a small learning communities grant, $1.7. Yeah, it's $2 million, which is great. We're in our third year. We're hoping for the renewal, which would be another 2 years. So a lot of the time is done after school. What started off as a heavy hourly wage for teachers to get together and meet and develop that culture of meeting after school is now predominantly volunteer. So a lot of the work that we do in our professional learning communities, where groups of like-minded teachers working on common assessments or is sharing innovative strategies, has come in an after-school setting. We're lucky enough to get out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so there are people that have plenty of time to do that. The professional development, I dedicate early release faculty work sessions. We don't have faculty meetings where I stand and everyone's out in front. Kind of what we're doing today, which I apologize for, but it was the best way to convey the information. We actually do work. We have work sessions where it's all small group work for professional development. So any spare time that we have with our teachers is all geared towards educating them on the improvement process and how they're involved. And like Chris said, it's led by other teachers who we've met with.
The science department next week, we're using a faculty meeting time for them to do that. You know what I mean? So it's already built in contractually and things like that we have 15 meetings, whatever. So David's been gracious to use those like more work sessions than just talking about
it. I think we're running out of time as well.
David, Chris, Keith, thank you very much for
Thank you.